This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we'll be taking a look at the human consequences of the U.S. war on drugs in this hemisphere. Also, as the U.N. General Assembly gets underway with its annual debate, we are joined live by David Swanson of War is a Crime. All that and more coming up on today's 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are very happy to have in the studio with us David Swanson, the author of War is a Crime, the progenitor of War is a Lie, and one of the great stalwarts in pursuit of peace on this earth. Welcome to the studios, David.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
David Swanson, you do so much work. Tell people about some of your projects.
Well, I work a lot now for an online group called RootsAction.org. We do activist campaigns online for peace and justice. We were set up with the intention of sort of being MoveOn.org even when Democrats are in power. And we've developed almost 200,000 people who are very active on our campaigns. And I am doing work for Veterans for Peace, paid work. I've long been an associate member. I'm not a veteran, but it's one of the best groups there is. And I'm traveling and going to meetings and giving speeches and trying to get an anti-war movement going in this country. I just came up on a train from Virginia to New York City, and I was on a phone call, and I mentioned the word peace, and this elderly couple comes up to me. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but just so thrilled to find out anybody is doing anything about peace anymore. And it's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, you won't even hear it as a pretense in our politicians' speeches. They don't even act like they're working for peace.
War has become a new norm. You were also involved in the After Downing Street project, were you not?
We started up that website, afterdowningstreet.org, back in 2005 when the Downing Street minutes and memos came out that were such powerful evidence that Bush had lied us into that war in Iraq. And then I later changed the name to warisacrime.org because I got tired of explaining what Downing Street was. But I think it was, it was a very interesting moment when the people who hate wars lined up with the people who hate Republican wars. And we had a pretty good size peace movement, and it had some impact, and it affected some elections and some policies and got a treaty at least finally through that Obama couldn't wiggle out of that took U.S. troops almost entirely out of Iraq.
What is the most frustrating thing you find, speaking of Downing Street and the way that there are clandestine operations going on in countries intended by the United States to be overthrown, and a synchrony of media, of press representations, of the general public consciousness, not that people really want war, but how they're manipulated? What kind of a system do you see and do you struggle against?
Yeah, a lot of people thought there was something new when Bush lied to us about weapons in Iraq and ties to terrorism from Iraq, and there was nothing new. What was new was sort of the incompetence of it, the way in which the lies were so blatantly and easily shown so quickly, not decades later, but so rapidly to have been false. The danger, of course, is them taking us into wars without lies, wars that they don't tell us about, wars that are so secret that we don't have the opportunity to say, we're on to you now. I wrote this book, War is a Lie, to try to preempt the next one, to say, look, we don't have to wait years or decades. We know from the start that every war is sold on the basis of lies. Here are the types of lies. Watch for which ones they use next time. Well, the problem is that now we have drone wars that aren't called wars. We have secret wars that aren't called wars. We've been killing thousands of people in Pakistan with drones, driven many times that number of people into refugee status, endless, countless injured and traumatized. I mean, and in Yemen, predictably, our drone war is now developing into a ground war. We're sending in the troops. And we don't think of these as wars. Congress doesn't authorize them in any way. The United Nations doesn't authorize them in any way. Some of them are run by the CIA, which was set up to be an information agency.
Shades of Eurasia and Oceania, of the secret, distant, remote wars whose conditions do not immediately touch us, but whose consequences eventually do. David Swanson, you are the author of War is a Lie, and that kind of reminds me of another person who made a very significant speech called War is a Racket. I'm speaking about Lieutenant General Smedley Butler in the middle to early days of the previous century. And your work with Veterans for Peace, I'm very curious about those who have been exposed to it, what they have to say about the national military and belligerency condition.
Veterans for Peace is one of the best organizations I know of. I'm not a veteran, but I've joined just as Code Pink is, and I'm not a woman, but I've joined. You know, I wish there was an Everybody for Peace group. We don't have that yet. But six members of Veterans for Peace are going to Pakistan next week with Code Pink, taking a delegation of 40 people over there to go to the area of the drone war to see it. Veterans for Peace is dedicated to abolishing all war. And works toward that end. And so it's a very principled group, a very courageous group, is always there where there are marches and sit-ins and civil disobedience, as well as lobbying meetings. It's an organization full of experts, former top officials within the military and in the CIA. And so we have some authority to bring into meetings, but we also have a position of opposing all wars from a very principled place, understanding them to be what Smedley Butler said they were.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. That's David Swanson. I'm Robert Knight. And here we are on the annual Fall Follies of the General Assembly, the debate, the general debate that brings in the heads of state. What possibly could have brought you into New York City today, David?
Well, primarily, I'm going to attend a meeting with the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He has made a habit on pretty much an annual basis of meeting with a few dozen peace activists in the United States, members of groups that have frequently requested meetings with Congress members and senators and President Obama and before him President Bush, and never been given the time of day. Are routinely invited to sit down and meet in this format and in others with the Iranian government. You don't have to believe someone is a saint and doesn't deserve any criticism and you're going to now be on his team and advertise for him to sit and talk with someone. There is much to be gained from sitting and talking and trying to understand where someone is coming from, particularly when our country is threatening to bomb his.
David, you know that the instantaneous ratings of this program just went through the roof, particularly in Fort Meade, when you announced that you will be meeting with President Ahmadinejad. What do you make of the speeches that were made today, in particular President Barack Obama's careful parsing of the consequences of Iran's energy development program?
Well, I was fortunate enough not to watch the president's speech, but I read a news summary, which I hope was accurate, and according to which he said once again, as is in the Democratic Party platform quite explicitly, we will militarily strike Iran if it does not stop violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as well as various UN resolutions. Iran, to my knowledge, is not violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel, which is behind this belligerence, is not even a party to it. And the United States is blatantly violating it by its failure to work toward disarmament. And so Iran, like Iraq 10 years ago, must do the impossible, right? Must prove it is going to stop violating a treaty it's not violating, or we will attack it. That is a violation of the UN Charter to threaten war. the president apparently failing to grasp the ironies here, said that if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, that will destroy the non-proliferation treaty. Again, Israel's not even party to it, and will result in a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. This, a country that we gave nuclear technology to decades ago, we put within inches of nuclear weaponry by giving nuclear energy, and surrounded by nations to which we've given nuclear weaponry, Israel, Pakistan, India, you know, everything is upside down in the view of the president and therefore of the corporate media.
One of the agencies of the United Nations is the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is tasked with monitoring energy developments and nuclear proliferation. What has been the history between Iran and the IAEA?
Well, as you may know, it is not still run by the same gentleman that it was when we were trying to get a war going in Iraq, we meaning the U.S. government. It has now at its head a U.S.-picked man who is still nonetheless is not supporting the claims that you're hearing out of Washington about Iran developing nuclear weapons. And in fact, when you pin them down, the Secretary of so-called Defense, the President, senators and Congress members will tell you, in agreement with the National Intelligence Estimate of 2007 that has been re-updated every year since, that Iran does not have any nuclear weapons program. So here we have, 30 countries doing war games in the Persian Gulf, cyber attacks, assassinations of scientists, buildings blown up in Iran, threats of war on Iran over something that we ourselves acknowledge does not exist.
As a matter of fact, the Iranian delegate to the IAEA on the 17th of September gave a rather startling address announcing that on the 17th of August, there had been the explosive destruction of power lines going to one of the nuclear fuel processing facilities inside Iran. That means that by all reasonable standards of observation, there is a clandestine war already underway inside Iran. Would you say that?
I don't think there's any dispute. You can pick particular incidents, but there is a pattern of assassinations of scientists, of sabotage of potential agreements the day before there was to be a meeting at which Iran was going to attempt once again to agree to export uranium for refinement and so forth, and not required by treaty, but in order to satisfy these demands, there was a building blown up in Iran that turned the government's sentiment against those negotiations. It is quite clear that the United States is not interested in resolving a crisis here, but in manufacturing one. And putting these ships in the Gulf and conducting these exercises and building up the level of hostility and tension on both sides, in Iran and in the United States, has the potential of taking us into a war despite some people's intentions.
What do you make of what seems to be a most significant development in the United States with the delisting of a counter-revolutionary movement in and around Iran, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq? The Obama administration has, I think, quite suddenly and with serious significance, licensed the way for them to be funded and to engage in further operations to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Are you alarmed by that development?
Absolutely, I am. This is a group that is an enemy, an opponent of the current regime in Iran, which simple-minded thinking would tell you is good for the Iranian people because this regime is evil. But in fact, external threats on nations and sanctions that punish the people of a nation, as we're currently imposing on Iran, by the way, cutting off their oil and their clean energy while we insist they don't develop nukes, tend to empower the right, tend to empower the nationalists, tend to empower, in fact, whoever is in power at the moment. You can recall Rudy Giuliani and George W. Bush suddenly becoming heroes when they'd been imbeciles the day before. Threats from outside have the reverse effect of what's supposedly intended. And so to take a terrorist organization and delist it as a terrorist organization in response to a campaign of multi-million dollars being spent on that in this country, the corruption of our high officials, and open the door to funding more covert warfare in Iran is a recipe for disaster.
Is it possible that one of the major targets of the newly, bureaucratically liberated terrorist organization, Mujahideen Iqbal, that one of the primary targets might be the hearts and minds of the American people almost as much as the facilities and leaders inside Iran?
It's possible. To the great credit of the American people, they have been very reluctant for years now to go along with the propaganda, in large part because of its similarity to the Iraq War propaganda and the extent to which that was exposed. But we're slipping a little bit. We're forgetting. We're pretending that this one might be different. This might be that good war we've been looking to find all these millennia. And it's entirely possible that the goal remains in the minds of some in Washington what it was in that secret meeting in Vice President Cheney's office that Seymour Hersh revealed, where the goal was to get some American blood spilled. They were coming up with plans to have U.S. ships pretend to be Iranian ships and shoot at U.S. ships. And they dropped the plan only because some people didn't want Americans shooting at Americans. But if you can spill American blood, you can turn a popular will around.
One of the complexities of the region is that Americans are subjected to propaganda of the order, whether it comes through the administration or its proxies or its presumed political antagonists, the Republican Party and the reactionaries, conservatives, and so on, that Iran is propping up a dictator in Syria. I was hearing this rhetoric just today.
Yes.
And we're speaking about Mujahideen Iqbal, but are we not seeing the same CIA template of subversion and armed propaganda and the massive funding and weaponizing of external parties in Syria in much the same way that the MEK process might unfold?
Indeed, the United States and its allies are funding and arming terrorists, as in Libya last year, as in Afghanistan, decades gone by for which we're still paying the price. We are funding racists, terrorists, child soldiers, religious fanatics, and splintered groups that don't get along with each other, and imagining that this time that will work out well, while pretending that it worked out well in Libya, while pretending that it worked out well in Afghanistan, pretending that it's worked out well in so many places in Latin America. It just hasn't yet worked. Meanwhile, the United States is propping up dictators all around that region, in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and a dozen other nations, and not telling the American public about their human rights abuses. You know, it's selective outrage here.
Let's talk about some of those. Bahrain, that's the site of a major United States naval and military base. Qatar, where do you begin to speak about Qatar with its Al Jazeera propagandizing on behalf of the overthrow of Libya and many other dirty operations like that? Where do you begin to talk about the training of the armed insurgents that overthrew the Jamahiriya? Where do you begin to talk about the massive funding through Qatar and Saudi Arabia to these movements? Let's talk about human rights in those areas.
Indeed. I mean, if you look at Bahrain, where the Fifth Fleet is parked and therefore they are our friend, you have not this inclination to bomb their houses to protect their human rights. Rather, you have top U.S. police officials who earned their stripes cracking skulls in New York and Philadelphia and Miami, sent over there to lead the abuse. You have immunity in courts and in the court of public opinion for Bahrain, for Saudi Arabia, for Qatar, when you could have very, very similar outrage, very, very similar abuses to what you're told to get outraged about in Libya or Syria or Iran. And so there are many people at low levels in the U.S. government who legitimately care about human rights. There are many people in the United States who are legitimately outraged about the human rights abuses they're shown. They just are shown them very selectively for political reasons, and they are not the reasons behind the push for war in each case in which we're told that we need to go to war. And in fact, as you say, Bahrain and Qatar and Saudi Arabia are arming terrorists in Syria, were arming rebels in Libya, including our former allies turned enemies from Afghanistan, including our recent enemies from Iraq. I mean, there seems to be nothing that's too far when you're trying to militarize a nonviolent movement or destabilize a country that many, including Senator McCain, are quite open about the reasoning being that overthrowing the government of Syria would be a blow to the government of Iran. I mean, there's no secret that that's the real motivation.
And into this comes battleship Turkey, the anchor of a major NATO base in Sirlik. And at Adana, there are camps and pretty much a Grand Central Station of extra-national terrorists going into Syria. NATO has so often been used as a fig leaf for invasion and intervention, as has the United Nations been used as a rubber stamp for the same, much to the rue and regret of nations like South Africa, nations like Russia, that in the Security Council went along with what any observer might have seen coming a mile away, of a pretext for invasion, a no-fly zone, that sort of thing. Can you address the issue of NATO, Turkey, and the extra-institutionalization of warfare from the Pentagon to these proxies?
Indeed. And of course, Russia, in this case, in Syria, is arming the government, which it ought not to be doing, and which I say on Russian television, it ought not to be doing any more than we ought to be arming all the other governments around that region and the rebels in that case. But NATO, you know, wants to own the world. I mean, it's not North Atlantic anymore. It wants to dominate the Mediterranean. Syria and Lebanon are a little glitch in that plan, and it wants to expand into Africa. It wants to be a force of empire, and it doesn't serve as a legal fig leaf. You know, the current administration in Washington tells Congress that if we use NATO, then our wars are legal, and even if we don't, then our wars are still legal. But NATO does not actually legalize anything under the UN Charter, much less the Kellogg-Briand Pact or our Constitution. It just makes it seem a little more international.
We're speaking with David Swanson. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the issue of Africa is one that I think is insufficiently pursued. For instance, one thinks of Libya as, well, let's say Arab nation, but it's not. It's an accumulation of three different districts, Fezzan, the Tripoli region, and the Cyrenaican region, whose racist rebels are now routing Afro-Libyans from entire villages and imprisoning and torturing them. And you have Egypt, again, the recipient of United States largesse in one of the biggest dollar amounts in U.S. foreign aid history. And one may not always consciously connect the fact that these are African nations, that the nation of Libya was instrumental in the formation and support of the African Union, that there might well have been an African dinar with a different stability and competition with the euro and the dollar. And there are drone attacks taking place every day in Somalia. There are interventions from Ethiopia, and even now one underway in Mogadishu from Kenya. Can you speak about how the war that has yet to fully boil is already underway in Africa.
Well, indeed. Libya and Iran and Syria have been on the list of nations to be targeted since Wesley Clark came out with what the Pentagon's list was in 2001, later more or less confirmed by Tony Blair. And the motivation has been in part the fear of a regional force, an African force, a financial force developing outside of the U.S., power. I mean, this is the terror that strikes the hearts of Washington when they see these non-aligned nations meeting in Iran and proposing nuclear disarmament, and when Brazil and Turkey figured out a plan to do everything the State Department supposedly wanted Iran to do, which was quite inappropriate. Africa is a new frontier for the Pentagon. AFRICOM, you know, we have these command centers to dominate each region of the globe. AFRICOM is not yet in Africa. Libya, maybe. Liberia, maybe. They need to figure out a place for the headquarters other than Germany. But they need to have control of Africa. This is their drive, global control. And we have troops secretly in some 70 or 80 nations. We don't know how many. We have drone strikes in Somalia, as well as in Yemen and Pakistan, routinely now. But we don't know. They don't tell us where. And we send troops into Africa in response to popular YouTube videos. But they don't leave after that. After the news has gone away, they're still there. And our troops have been in more countries almost every
Uganda
year.
Uganda also.
Right. Yeah, that's what the one I'm thinking about. But not just Africa, Latin America, Asia, mm-hmm. Australia, the Pacific. Our troops are in more places almost every year since Bush and Obama have been around. And they don't come back home again. We are expanding our empire of bases, not to mention our arming of all of these other nations' governments, which is a way that these alliances are made. Last year, we tripled our sales of weapons to foreign dictatorships and other nations, $66 billion, 80-some percent of world weapons sales. Russia comes in second at 5%. We are the weapons supplier to the world. So when you take that nice cushy job for that weapons maker and you think it's just for good old patriotic American wars, you have to realize that, you know, the two sides in that war in Libya could have exchanged guns or bullets. You know, we arm the world and we later fight wars against U.S. made weapons. Well, we don't make anything else anymore.
The quiet wars. United States weapons. Can you speak a bit more to the overview of the robotic murders that are taking place with drones?
Well, there's this notion that it's somehow more humanitarian, all right? But, you know, I've literally had people tell me drones are better than armies because with drones, nobody gets killed, right? Nobody, meaning none of that 5% of humanity that lives in the United States. Now, of course, the drone pilots are getting post-traumatic stress disorder more than the regular Air Force pilots because they watch families for days or weeks and then they blow them up. That's traumatic. And there is blowback and there will be blowback. But the thinking is that you're not risking U.S. lives. The other 95% of humanity isn't worth a darn, and so drones are better. And they're more humanitarian because they kill fewer of those people, too. But we didn't have a ground war in Yemen. We went in with a drone war. We turned the nation of Yemen against us and its own government, and we now are having to send in the Marines. Predictably enough, we're going to create ground wars where there weren't any with the drone wars, which are absolutely illegal. Assassinations are illegal. The United Nations says the drone wars are illegal. They are secret. We aren't told what they are. And the president, when asked, and he was just asked recently about this policy of maintaining a list of who he wants to kill and checking people off every Tuesday, said, listen, I don't check with any courts. I don't check with any legislature. I don't check with the public. But a bunch of people who work for me look at this stuff very carefully. And that's the checks and balances. And that's your constitutional due process. I'll think about it very carefully. And then I'll kill you. This is part of the blowback. these policies that we adopt for foreigners, for dark-skinned, Muslim, non-English-speaking foreigners, get back to us very, very quickly. And it's now official policy to lock up Americans, too, to assassinate Americans, too, at least four of them thus far, with drones, including teenagers.
That's David Swanson of Roots Action and War is a Crime and War is a Lie. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and I know you have an important meeting coming up soon. So I would ask you, in summary today, have you found any other historical moment to compare with this, with the United States and its European allies, in such a dominant control of both economy and military of so much of the world? I mean, the mind wobbles to try and find a comparison. Could the heyday of ancient Rome be any comparison, or the days of the Mongols in the then traveled part of the world? Or is there any comparison to be made with other great empires like General Electric or Bechtel?
Yes, I think these are all the obvious comparisons, and the British and the Spanish and the Dutch, but I think which were in some ways corporate as well. I think there really isn't one that measures up in terms of reach, in terms of dominance, in terms of power. I think that we fought a revolution in this country against King George and laid out his abuses in a Declaration of Independence, and it just didn't come close to the powers we now give presidents, right? We've empowered presidents with a global reach, with weapons beyond the wildest imagination of the 18th century, with powers that King George never dreamed of, that in fact his predecessors for hundreds of years never dreamed of. Habeas corpus is gone. The Magna Carta is shredded. And we think it's okay because they're keeping us safe from terrorists. That is, some of us think that. Some of us know that we're being taken for a ride, and hence the outrage. Hence, Congress is under 10% popularity. Half the people are not going to vote, even for president. People are fed up and disgusted, as they should be. They just need to get more active and understand that we have the power to change things, and it doesn't usually happen through elections.
Well, I wish you the greatest of enlightenment with your activities later in the day, and ask you once more to tell people how they can find out how it went and follow your work with the veterans, with Roots Action, and the other things you're doing.
Well, I'll certainly post some kind of account of the meeting with Ahmadinejad at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org and other progressive websites. And by all means, check out veteransforpeace.org and rootsaction.org.
Well, thank you, David Swanson. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on this first day of the general debate of the United Nations General Assembly. We'll be back with more.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin today by telling you about an American named Chris Stevens. Now, Chris was born in a town called Grass Valley, California, the son of a lawyer and a musician. As a young man, Chris joined the Peace Corps and taught English in Morocco. And he came to love and respect the people of North Africa and the Middle East. He would carry that commitment throughout his life. As a diplomat, he worked from Egypt to Syria, from Saudi Arabia to Libya. He was known for walking the streets of the cities where he worked, tasting the local food, meeting as many people as he could, speaking Arabic, listening with a broad smile. Chris went to Benghazi in the early days of the Libyan Revolution, arriving on a cargo ship. As America's representative, he helped the Libyan people as they coped with violent conflict, cared for the wounded, and crafted a vision for the future in which the rights of all Libyans would be respected. And after the revolution, he supported the birth of a new democracy as Libyans held elections and built new institutions and began to move forward after decades of dictatorship. Chris Stevens loved his work. He took pride in the country he served, and he saw dignity in the people that he met. And 2 weeks ago, he traveled to Benghazi to review plans to establish a new cultural center and modernize a hospital. That's when America's compound came under attack. Along with three of his colleagues, Chris was killed in the city that he helped to save. He was 52 years old. I tell you this story because Chris Stevens embodied the best of America. Like his fellow Foreign Service officers, he built bridges across oceans and cultures and was deeply invested in the international cooperation that the United Nations represents. He acted with humility, but he also stood up for a set of principles, a belief that individuals should be free to determine their own destiny and live with liberty, dignity, justice, and opportunity. The attacks on the civilians in Benghazi were attacks on America. We are grateful for the assistance we received from the Libyan government and from the Libyan people. There should be no doubt that we will be relentless in tracking down the killers and bringing them to justice. And I also appreciate that in recent days, the leaders of other countries in the region, including Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, have taken steps to secure our diplomatic facilities and called for calm. And so have religious authorities around the globe. But understand, the attacks of the last 2 weeks are not simply an assault on America. They are also an assault on the very ideals upon which the United Nations was founded. The notion that people can resolve their differences peacefully, that diplomacy can take the place of war, that in an interdependent world, all of us have a stake in working towards greater opportunity and security for our citizens. If we are serious about upholding these ideals, it will not be enough to put more guards in front of an embassy or to put out statements of regret and wait for the outrage to pass. If we are serious about these ideals, we must speak honestly about the deeper causes of the crisis, because we face a choice between the forces that would drive us apart and the hopes that we hold in common. Today, we must reaffirm that our future will be determined by people like Chris Stevens and not by his killers. Today, we must declare that this violence and intolerance has no place among our United Nations. It's been less than 2 years since a vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire to protest the oppressive corruption in his country and sparked what became known as the Arab Spring. And since then, the world has been captivated by the transformation that's taken place. And the United States has supported the forces of change. We were inspired by the Tunisian protests that toppled a dictator because we recognized our own beliefs in the aspiration of men and women who took to the streets. We insisted on change in Egypt because our support for democracy ultimately put us on the side of the people. We supported a transition of leadership in Yemen because the interests of the people were no longer being served by a corrupt status quo. We intervened in Libya alongside a broad coalition and with the mandate of the United Nations Security Council because we had the ability to stop the slaughter of innocents and because we believed that the aspirations of the people were more powerful than a tyrant. And as we meet here, we again declare that the regime of Bashar al-Assad must come to an end so that the suffering of the Syrian people can stop and a new dawn can begin. We have taken these positions because we believe that freedom and self-determination are not unique to one culture. These are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values. And even as there will be huge challenges to come with a transition to democracy, I am convinced that ultimately government of the people, by the people, and for the people is more likely to bring about the stability, prosperity, and individual opportunity that serve as a basis for peace in our world. So let us remember that this is a season of progress. For the first time in decades, Tunisians, Egyptians, and Libyans voted for new leaders in elections that were credible, competitive, and fair. This democratic spirit has not been restricted to the Arab world. Over the past year, we've seen peaceful transitions of power in Malawi and Senegal, and a new president in Somalia. In Burma, a president has freed political prisoners and opened a closed society. A courageous dissident has been elected to parliament.
And people... President Barack Obama, addressing the opening session of the 67th Annual General Assembly debate, beginning with a characterization of U.S. operations in Libya that is at odds with many things that we are discovering today, among them the reversal of the White House in saying that it was a spontaneous attack on the Benghazi consulate that resulted in the death of four Americans, including the United States Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens. He went on a gossip television program earlier today to say there's no doubt that it was a terrorist action. The United Nations Ambassador from the United States, Susan Rice, insisted that it was spontaneous event. In fact, there are now doubts about the story as to whether or not there really was an anti-Islamic film protest taking place when, with great specificity, both the consulate and the backup safe house were attacked. Not mentioned in President Obama's speech was the fact that Ambassador Stevens was in Benghazi specifically to further negotiate or make deals about the export of Libyan oil. That was on his agenda. And today, the Daily Telegraph is reporting that documents and other information retrieved from the burnt-out compound indicate that there were multiple Central Intelligence Agency operations underway inside Libya. According to the Telegraph, a large number of Americans whose existence was unknown to Libyan leaders were evacuated from Benghazi, even as fighting around the compound continued. The new briefings admit that they were involved in CIA or other intelligence operations targeting Islamist activity in the rest of the east of the country, as well as securing some of the more dangerous weapons with which the country is infested. That because of the overthrow of the more stable Libyan Arab Jamahiriya under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi. We'll have more on that in the coming days. One other item, even as we speak, there are reports of there being gunfights between the militias that have been unleashed as the real power of Libya today, this time in Tripoli, outside the so-called New Libyan National Congress. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we look at another side of United States covert operations and clandestine warfare, from Plan Colombia to the new turmoil in Mexico and its consequences in shifting the international balance of drug production and international transport, with Peru rising as a fast comer in this business now. This summer, victims of the drug war in Mexico came to the United States. They walked, they traveled, they rode to raise awareness about their struggle and to ask the Obama administration to stop allocating money and arms in a war that's killed 60,000 people in the past few years, most of them innocent civilians. The Caravan for Peace, as it is called, the Caravan for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, stopped recently at New York City's famously historic Riverside Church, and our reporter, Thiago Peroso, was there.
It took nearly a month for Margarita López Pérez to make it from northern Mexico to the steps of New York's legendary Riverside Church. Sometimes riding and sometimes marching, López and other victims of Mexico's drug war crossed the border and visited American cities seeking justice in a transborder caravan for peace, justice, and dignity. Caravan coordinator Jane Gallagher.
We began in San Diego, California on August 12th. We crossed from Tijuana on August 11th, and we're here doing two things. First, we're making known what's going on in Mexico in terms of violence, especially disappearances and assassinations related to the drug war. We've brought more than 40 family members of direct victims of this violence to tell their stories about what's happening in Mexico so that people in the U.S. realize what's happening and also start thinking about the role of the U.S. in what's happening. We've also been on a listening tour. We've been in, I think we've already been in 23 different communities, hearing also from people in the U.S. about how they're affected by the drug war, about how they're affected by some of the same policies that are being implemented in Mexico. So we've unfortunately heard that we have shared pain, that these same policies, these failed drug war policies are hurting people on both sides of the border. Basically, a war that was created by the Calderon government in 2006 when they decided to crack down on the cartels. This kind of crackdown on the cartels has created kind of an explosion of violence that the government continues to claim that most people caught up in this violence are themselves culpable in some way. But what I see, what the research shows, is that the people that are becoming victims oftentimes have nothing to do with the cartels and are just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's tragic. It's a human tragedy of disturbing and huge proportion.
Like other caravan participants, Margarita Lopez was directly affected by the drug war. Her daughter has been missing since April 13, 2011, when she was abducted from her home by an armed commando. Lopez claims that a criminal organization linked to drug trafficking, as well as Mexican authorities, is involved in the disappearance of her daughter. Through a translator, she tells her story.
My daughter was married to a soldier from the Special Forces, and she had moved to Oaxaca to live just 1 month before she disappeared. Because of this, I moved to the city of Oaxaca the following day to investigate what had happened to her. The authorities never wanted to help me with the investigation. They told me that maybe my daughter had run away with another man, and that I should investigate, that I should contract my own investigators or informants. I started by contracting informants from all different government agencies, and including from within organized crime. From the investigation, I found that there were over 100 women who were minors who had been deprived of their liberty. I asked for support from the military because I trusted the military more at that point, but they denied support. They never wanted to rescue those young women who had been deprived of their freedom. And I had hoped that my daughter might be among those young women.
Frustrated by the lack of assistance from local officials, Lopez started visiting prisons to collect information from incarcerated members of criminal groups. A few weeks into this investigation, she learned that Los Zetas, which the U.S. government calls the most technologically advanced, sophisticated, and dangerous cartel operating in Mexico, was behind the kidnapping and murder of her daughter.
For the last few months, I have been going to Mexico's, the country's maximum security prisons, to interview members of criminal organizations who are detained there for other crimes unrelated to my daughter's. They told me that they were the people who had removed my daughter from her home.
What is the name of this organization?
¿Cuál es el nombre de esa organización?
Los Zetas. Ellos me dijeron que habían sacado a mi hija dentro de su casa por órdenes de una persona.
They told me that they had removed my daughter from her home at the orders of someone from the government. They had been told that my daughter was a member of the criminal organization, the Familia Michoacana, just because they realized that my daughter was from the state of Michoacán. They had tortured her for more than 8 days. They had raped her, and they had taken her to the mass grave where my daughter was going to be assassinated. He said that after torturing my daughter, they had realized that she was innocent, but that the order from above was that they needed to assassinate my daughter and that she should not reappear alive. They told me in great detail all of the things that they had done to her until her last moments, and that they showed her the place where she was going to be buried. They told me that my daughter had begged for her life and had said that she was innocent, and that they had decapitated her alive and thrown her body in this mass grave. I asked Mexican government officials to go with, to demand that these criminals take them to the place where my daughter was supposedly buried, but they have refused to comply. All of the government authorities in my country have links to organized crime.
In a room filled with sorrow and pain, victims of drug war found strength to overcome their grief by sharing their stories. All of them want to speak. They complain that their voices are not heard in Mexico. Guadalupe Aguilar recalls her encounter with the Mexican president, Felipe Calderón, who promised to help find her son, José Luis Arreña, missing since January 17, 2011.
Él iba en su vehículo y él... vehículo apareció en otro estado.
He was driving his car, and later the car appeared in another state of Mexico in the hands of criminals. I investigated throughout the state of Colima and interviewed many people from the population, but many of them are very afraid. The police have left me alone. I've walked everywhere alone or with my family members because the police don't help me. A year ago on September 7th, I spoke with President Felipe Calderón and he promised to help me find my son. But over a year has passed now and we still don't know anything about my son. If you go to the highest authority in your country and then nothing happens, you have to raise your voice so that you can be heard.
Raise your voice. That was the feeling that motivated the Mexican poet Javier Cecilia to start the Caravan for Peace, Justice and Dignity. His son was killed along with six other people by members of a drug cartel. After that, Cecilia wrote his last poem and became the leader of a national protest against the drug war.
La importancia es...
the importance of this is that the drug war is destroying us. The Latin American communities and the African Americans are being destroyed by the state. This tonight is to draw a bridge between the two communities to show how the problem in Mexico is also a problem here. The war against drugs is an absurd war, and it only benefits criminals, whether they're from corporation, whether they're from mafias. It seems like this war is actually made to destroy the communities.
Mark Johnson of the Fellowship of Reconciliation criticized American support for the drug war and the corporations that benefit from it, recalling a speech made by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in the same Riverside Church some 45 years ago.
As the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us in his April 4th, 1967 speech in this church, in which he condemned American imperialism by identifying the evil triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism, the culture of this nation drives the violence suffered throughout Central America and South America in irresponsible and unacceptable ways. The market for and consumption of drugs grown and processed in the South for a hedonistic and largely unsanctioned user population in the United States further drives violence in the South. The manufacture, sale, and distribution of arms as a core and defining part of U.S. economy and culture is the third leg of the root source of violence throughout the world, but so tragically now, especially in Mexico, where more than 60,000 people have died during the Calderón regime. The horrific violence being suffered in Mexico today, inflicted by American-made arms to support American drug addictions and dismissed with racist, bigoted biases, all of which we must repent for, reject, and correct. Muchas gracias.
Thiago Barroso reporting for 5 o'clock Shadow. And that concludes today's edition. The program was produced with reporting by Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow at WBAI.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.